Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, we take a look at the man who may become the top law enforcement officer in the United States, William Pelham Barr. Barr has been nominated by the current occupant of the Oval Office to be the next U.S. Attorney General. The Senate Judiciary Committee held its nomination hearings on January 15th and 16th, and they are expected to vote on his nomination on January 29th. Barr has experience in the role of Attorney General, having served as AG under George H.W. Bush from 1991 until January 1993. Though his time as Attorney General was brief, while in that post, Barr managed to leave an indelible mark on American society. As the American Civil Liberties Union notes, quote, "While serving in the George H.W. Bush administration, Barr helped develop what became a blueprint for the National Security Agency's mass phone surveillance program. In 1992, he and his then-deputy, Robert Mueller, authorized the Drug Enforcement Administration to begin amassing phone call data in bulk, ordering telephone companies to secretly hand over the records of all phone calls from the U.S. to countries, which eventually grew to be well over 100 nations, where the government believed drug traffickers were operating." End quote. Today, we're going to take a look at William Barr and some of the reasons why he is unsuitable to be the next U.S. Attorney General. I mentioned that the Senate Judiciary Committee held its confirmation hearing for Barr's appointment on January 15th and 16th. Let's start by listening to parts of that confirmation hearing. First, here's Senator Amy Klobuchar.
My dad was a reporter, so I grew up knowing the importance of a free press. We obviously have the tragic case of a journalist who worked right here at the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi, and it's a particular concern. So I want to ask you something I ask Attorney General Sessions. If you're confirmed, will the Justice Department jail reporters for doing their jobs?
I think that, I know there are guidelines in place, and I can conceive of situations where, as a last resort, and where a news organization has run through a red flag or something like that, knows that they're putting out stuff that will hurt the country. There could be a situation where someone would be held in contempt. But
well, Attorney General Sessions had said he was going to look at potentially changing those rules at one point. So I'd like you to maybe respond in writing to this.
That was William Barr responding to a question from Senator Amy Klobuchar. On a personal note, I don't really look that bad in an orange jumpsuit. Next, let's listen to Senator Cory Booker as he questions Barr on mass incarceration and racial disparities.
During your previous tenure as Attorney General, you literally wrote the book on mass incarceration, or at least wrote this report, The Case for More Incarceration. You argue that we as a nation were, quote, incarcerating too few criminals.
In those days.
And that the solution was more incarceration for more people.
For chronic violent offenders and gun offenders.
Well, I mean that's the challenge, sir. And you argued against the bipartisan legislation in 2015 quite strenuously.
I did.
But that's not the nature of incarceration in this country. In fiscal year 2016, only 7.7% of the federal prison population was convicted of violent crimes. Overwhelmingly, what was initiated in those times that led to an 800% increase in the federal prison population, overwhelmingly, that was nonviolent drug offenders. Except right now, our federal prison population is overwhelmingly nonviolent. 47.5% of the federal prison population are incarcerated for drug offenses. And I guess hearing your arguments then and hearing your arguments against the bipartisan legislation that we brought out of the committee in 2016.
Senator, I think that's wrong, what you just said, okay? I think when you have violent gangs in the city, killing people, murder and so forth and so on, sometimes the most readily provable charge is their drug trafficking offenses, rather than proving culpability of the whole gang for murder. So you can take out a gang on drug offenses, and you could be taking out a lot of violent offenders. Do you think that the murders in Chicago are they're related to gangs,
and we can get into the data if you'd like, and I'd like to get some more pointed questioning. But this is the sort of these are sort of the tropes that make people believe that in inner cities we should have such profound incarceration rates. And I'd like to ask you specifically about that data, because I think it's language like that makes me kind of concerned and worried. You said you hadn't reviewed, earlier in your testimony, you hadn't reviewed criminal justice data about this actual issue of incarceration versus non-incarceration. I just want to know, will you commit to commissioning a study on just the concerns that we're talking about right now about the efficacy of reducing mass incarceration and publish those results? Would you be willing to do such a study yourself?
Well, no, as I understand it, I've been told that there's a lot of data to support the First Step Act.
Yeah, and that First Step Act goes directly towards addressing a lot of the problems we've had in mass incarceration. And so if you're saying that it is necessary to deal with violence in communities by over-incarcerating, here's a bipartisan group of senators that's working towards reducing mass incarceration. And that's why I think it's very important, which I appreciate you saying you didn't know because you hadn't reviewed the data. I think it's very important that you review the data and understand the implications for the language that you're using, which brings up this language of race, which is often not said explicitly, but when you talk about Chicago in the way you just did, it brings up racial fears or racial concerns. And you stated that if a black and a white, this is quoting you directly, are charged with the same offense, generally they will get the same treatment in the system and ultimately the same penalty. You previously quoted, and I quote you again, there's no statistical evidence of racism in the criminal justice system. Do you still believe that?
No, what I said was that I think that's taken out of a broader quote, which is the whole criminal justice system involves both federal but also state local justice systems. And I said there's no doubt that there are places where there is racism still in the system. But I said overall, I thought that as a system, it's working. It's not predicated on
that. So can I press you on that? Overall, the system treats blacks and whites fairly. From my own experience, I've lived in affluent communities. I've gone to the college campuses with you. There are certain drug laws applied there that's very different than the inner city community in which I live. But let's talk stats. Let's not talk our personal experiences. And so I've sat with many of my colleagues and many conservatives who readily admit what the data shows. And so I have a whole bunch of reports, which I'll enter into the record, from nonpartisan, bipartisan groups, even conservative leaders, talking about the rife nature of racial bias within the system. For example, the federal government's own data, the U.S. Sentencing Commission's research shows that federal prosecutors are more likely to charge blacks with offenses that carry harsh mandatory minimum sentences than similarly situated for whites. The federal government's own data shows that black defendants were subject to three-strike sentencing enhancements at a statistically significantly higher rate, which added, on average, over 10 years to their sentences. And so with numerous researchers having found stunning racial disparities rife throughout our system and in the federal system, which you will be the chief law enforcement officer of, and primarily overwhelmingly for drug laws. For example, I don't know if you're aware or not of the Brookings study that found that blacks are 3.6 times more likely to be arrested for selling drugs, despite the fact that whites are actually more likely to sell drugs in the United States of America. And blacks are 2.5 times more likely to be arrested for possession of drugs when there is no difference racially in America for the usage and possession of drugs in the United States. I don't know if you're, are you familiar with the Brookings study?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so just a follow-up. Will you commit to commissioning a study examining racial disparities and the disparate impacts of the policies that, that you talked about in that led to mass incarceration, the policies that you defended when you criticized the bipartisan 2015 sentencing reform legislation? Will you commit to at least, as the most important law enforcement officer in the land, to studying those well-documented racial disparities and the impacts it has?
Of course I'll commit to studying that, and I'll have the Bureau of Justice Statistics pull together everything they have, and if there's something lacking, I'll get that, and I'm interested in state experience, but when I looked at this, I think 1992 was a different time, Senator. The crime rate had quintupled over the preceding 30 years, and it peaked in 1992. And it's been coming down since 1992.
And sir, I just want to tell you, I was a young black guy in 1990s. I was a 20-something-year-old and experienced a dramatically different justice system in the treatment that I received. Okay. And the data of racial disparities and what it's done to black communities, because you literally said this about black communities, and I know that your heart was in the right place. You said that, hey, I want to help black communities. This is what you're saying. The benefits of incarceration would be enjoyed disproportionately by black Americans living in inner cities. You also said that, quote, a failure to incarcerate hurts black Americans most.
And I'll tell you what's...
And I just want to ask you a yes or no question, because I have seconds left. Do you believe now 30, 40 years of mass incarceration targeted disproportionately towards African Americans, harsher sentences, disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system, with the American Bar Association talking about once you've been incarcerated for even a low-level drug crime, there are 40,000 collateral consequences that impact your life, jobs, Pell Grants, loans from banks. Do you think, just yes or no, that this system of mass incarceration has disproportionately benefited African-American communities? Yes or no, sir?
I think the reduction in crime has since 1992, but I think that the heavy drug penalties, especially on crack and other things, have harmed the black community. The incarceration rates have harmed the black community.
And I would just conclude to my chairman and partner, thank you, sir, on this, because I'm really grateful for this bipartisan group, the Heritage Foundation. I've spoken at the AEI conference, just found such great partnership, but I worry about the highest law enforcement officer in the land and some of the language I still hear you using that goes against the data, and that you're going to be expected to oversee a justice system that you and I both know needs the faith and confidence of communities that has dramatically lost that confidence because of implicit racial bias. And the DOJ, and I'll give you a chance to respond, the DOJ itself has said, mandated implicit racial bias training, and I hope that's something that you will agree to do, but this is the thing I'll conclude on, is that we live on a planet Earth where you can tell the most about a nation by who they incarcerate. In Turkey, they incarcerate journalists. Thank God we don't do that here, even though they've been called the enemy of the people. In Russia, they incarcerate political opponents. I'm glad we don't do that, even though with chance of lock her up. But you go into the American criminal prison, sir, and you see the most vulnerable people. You see over-stigmatized mentally ill people clogging our system. You see over-stigmatized addicted people clogging our system. You see a system where, as Brian Stevenson says, it treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And you see disproportionately, overwhelmingly for drug crimes, African Americans and Latinos being incarcerated. The importance of your job, and I'll ask you this last question, because you haven't met with me yet, you've given that courtesy to others, would you please meet with me in my office so you and I can have a heart-to-heart on the urgency, the cancer on the soul of our country's criminal justice system, is the disproportionate impact of that system on those vulnerable communities, including women, over 80% of whom the women we incarcerate, are survivors of sexual trauma. Can you and I sit down and have a longer conversation than these 10 minutes will allow on this issue?
I'd very much welcome that, Senator. My experience back in 1992, when sort of blood was running on the streets all over the United States, my ideas were actually first formed when I went to Trenton And the African-American community there essentially surrounded me and was saying, look, we're in our golden years. We're trying to enjoy our golden years, and we can't even go outside our house. We have bars on our house and so forth. Please, will you, these gangs are running roughshod. So I developed this idea called Weed and Seed. And my attitude was, look, let's stop arguing past each other on let's attack root causes and let's get tough on crime. And I felt that for programs to work, like after school programs and so forth, for all this, you know, for housing projects to be safe, we needed strong enforcement in those communities, and we needed those other programs to be brought to bear community by community. And it had to be done with the leadership of the community. And that was this idea of the partnership. And it caught on. It was very popular. And in fact, it was continued by a lot of the U.S. attorneys in the Clinton administration after the Bush administration was out. And it is actually under a number of different names has continued. So I'm very conscious of the issues you raise, but my goal is to provide safety in these neighborhoods for the people trying to raise their children and for the older people and so forth. And I think the neighborhoods are, you know, the crime rate has gone down. I make a distinction between the way we treat these chronic violent offenders and the drug penalties. The drug penalties, as I said, very high and draconian, and in some cases that might have been necessary. But I supported revisiting the penalty structure.
And, sir, I'm the only United States senator that lives in an inner-city, low-income community. I've had shootings in my neighborhood. A young man killed last year on my block with an assault weapon. I know this urgent need for safety and security, and I actually, I'm not saying I'm necessarily going to vote for you one way or the other, but I believe your intentions are well, but I think that some of the things you've said in the past lead me to believe that your policies might be misguided in the way that Mike Lee and Cornyn and Graham and Grassley have been incredible partners in changing the American reality. I hope that you can be that kind of partner too, and I hope that you and I can have a good heart-to-heart conversation, trusting that we both want the same end for all communities, safety and security, but a justice system that is fair to all American citizens.
I'd welcome that, sir.
Thank you, sir.
That was Senator Cory Booker questioning William Barr about mass incarceration and racial disparities. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. We're looking at the man who may and should not become the next U.S. Attorney General, William Pelham Barr. A number of civil rights, social justice, and other progressive organizations have declared their opposition to the Barr nomination and are calling on senators to reject Barr. The Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and 78 other organizations have sent a letter to members of the Senate expressing their opposition to Barr's nomination. The letter reads in part, quote, "Many of the organizations previously wrote to the Senate expressing serious concerns about Mr. Barr's nomination. Those concerns, based on his long record of advancing positions that restricted civil and human rights in America, and his lack of independence, as evidenced by his vocal criticism of the Mueller investigation, were not allayed by his hearing testimony. Regrettably, they were reinforced. We urge the Senate to oppose his confirmation." End quote. The full text of that letter is available at the website civilrights.org. The Leadership Conference also coordinated a news conference in mid-January in which representatives from several organizations presented reasons to oppose Barr's nomination. In the time we have left, we're going to hear parts of that news conference. Let's start with Christine Lucius, Executive Vice President for Policy at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
This nomination comes at a critical moment for our nation. The current president's flagrant disregard for democratic norms, the rule of law, and the civil and human rights of our nation's most vulnerable threatens to totally destabilize our nation. The confirmation of the next chief law enforcement officer is one of the most important issues the Senate will consider. And the Senate has got to get it right. The Senate should only confirm someone with the necessary independence to run the Justice Department consistent with its mission. That requires someone who has a demonstrated commitment to enforcing our nation's federal civil rights laws on behalf of our nation's most vulnerable. That's non-negotiable. Under former Attorney General Sessions, we saw nearly unbridled disdain for the Justice Department's vital role as the nation's primary agency for protecting people's rights. For nearly 2 years, Sessions destroyed families and communities by attacking voting rights, restarting the war on drugs, failing to enforce constitutional policing policies, rolling back protections for LGBTQ individuals, and justifying officials separating children from their parents and locking immigrant children in cages. As you will hear from the speakers on today's call, Mr. Barr's record suggests more of the same. Our families and our communities deserve better. An attorney general who will protect the rights of all, not criminalize our most vulnerable. Our civil rights are at stake. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee have an obligation next week to seek assurances from Mr. Barr that he will not be Sessions 2.0. He must demonstrate he will not continue to turn back the clock on civil rights, and he must demonstrate he will be truly independent from the divisive and lawless president who nominated him. The nominee has the burden of proof in these hearings, and the more we learn about Mr. Barr's record, the heavier that burden is getting.
That was Christine Lucius, Executive Vice President for Policy at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. She was speaking at a news conference in which civil rights and social justice organizations urged opposition to the nomination of William Pelham Barr as the next U.S. Attorney General. Let's hear now from Janae Nelson, Associate Director, Counsel, NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
We are at a time when schools are resegregating and black and brown students are increasingly attending racially isolated, high-poverty schools, and the Trump administration has made a concerted effort to dismantle diversity from kindergarten through college. From rescinding departmental guidance on discriminatory school discipline policies to leading investigations into Ivy League institutions regarding a racial diversity program, this administration has been on a warpath against educational equity. Similarly, the Department of Justice has also become this administration's voter suppression agency. In one of his first acts as Attorney General, the Sessions-led DOJ sided with the state of Texas in an effort to impose a discriminatory photo ID scheme, asking a federal court of appeals to allow the state to enforce a law that the lower court found to be discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act and the 14th and 15th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. And this is in a case where the Department of Justice had worked with civil rights groups to help challenge this discriminatory law and then did a 180 right after Sessions became installed as the new head of DOJ. DOJ also sided with Ohio in an effort to unfairly purge voters from the roll. In the area of policing and criminal justice reform, Jeff Sessions revived the private prison contract that had been ended by the previous administration and abandoned the department's obligation to ensure that criminal laws are administered fairly and without regard to race. Despite a decades-long history of police abuse in Baltimore and Chicago, DOJ took steps to prevent the approval of consent decrees to address documented civil rights violations. These are agreements DOJ is authorized to negotiate pursuant to the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994. The Trump DOJ has also attacked the LGBTQ community. It issued a sweeping religious exemption guidance, which invited taxpayer-funded federal agencies, government employees, and government contractors to legally discriminate against LGBT communities and employees as long as they cite a religious belief as the reason for doing it. It also reversed the policy that provided non-discrimination protections for transgender people in the workplace under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Jeff Sessions was the messenger when the Trump administration announced its plans to end DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, an Obama-era immigration policy that protected innocent youth from deportation. It's a disastrous and cruel decision that is still hanging in the balance and could devastate the lives, and is devastating the lives, of hundreds and thousands of children and families. It is yet another example of this administration's willingness to fan the flames of xenophobia and hostility toward people of color. This is the legacy that the prior Attorney General and the Department of Justice that Barr will lead if he is confirmed. And Barr's record demonstrates that he also supports mass incarceration, opposes sensible criminal justice reform, is hostile to LGBTQ rights, and objects to any legislative checks on executive power. These are concerning attributes of a potential appointment to lead the Department of Justice. Senators must determine whether Barr is going to continue to weaponize the Justice Department and eviscerate civil rights protections, or whether his records are death that he can repair and restore integrity and fairness to the Justice Department, whether he can ensure that all persons are treated equally under the law. We need an attorney general who has the will to act independently of a president under investigation, who has the will to reverse the assault on civil rights set in motion by his predecessor, and has the will to aggressively protect and defend the civil rights of all Americans. We at the Legal Defense Fund, along with our colleagues here today, have very serious doubts that William Barr has that will, and we urge the Senate Judiciary Committee to engage in a full and thorough vetting to properly satisfy its duty to advise and consent.
That was Janae Nelson, Associate Director, Counsel, NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. She was speaking at a news conference in which civil rights and social justice organizations urged opposition to the nomination of William Pelham Barr as the next U.S. Attorney General. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you have been listening to Prison Pipeline. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the website at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Many thanks to our engineers, Danielle Parks and Mike Fetakis, and a heartfelt thanks to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!